In 1878, a Congregationalist minister named Oscar McCulloch came across an extended family living in one of the most rundown neighborhoods in the city of Indianapolis. He discovered that this family was called the Ishmaels, and when he talked with local officials, they told him that these people were at the center of a group of related families that were well known for crime and pauperism. And the man, that is Oscar McCulloch, devoted much of the next 10 years to researching and publicizing what he claimed was a tribe of savages living in the heart of the city. Today, the story of the Ishmaelites has largely been forgotten, but the work that McCulloch did was taken up by other people. And in fact, in America in the 1920s, the Ishmaelites were certainly well known, and in fact, they were synonymous with the idea of the undeserving poor. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about this story, and we'll be talking with Nathaniel Deutsch. He's professor of literature and history at University of California, Santa Cruz, and he writes about this in a book that's titled Inventing America's Worst Family, the subtitle Eugenics, Islam, and the Fall and Rise of the Tribe of Ishmael. The book is published by the University of California Press. It is in the paper, and it's a very interesting story, so you might want to seek it out. And of course, this morning as we talk and tell the story, questions from people who are listening are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Either one, whichever works for you, you can call in. The only thing we ask of callers is that just people try to keep their comments and questions brief so we can accommodate as many callers as we can and keep things moving. But, of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to join the conversation. Professor Deutsch, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks, and yourself?
Good. Thank you for having me.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to talk and tell this story. And I think, you know, one of the things that I really like having the chance to do is to, on this program, is to go back and introduce people to forgotten stories, things that maybe at one time would have been something that had been people knew about, people talked about, and yet for one reason or another had been forgotten. And certainly this story not only is interesting because it's a forgotten story, but when you see the various incarnations, and we'll talk about this, you know, the various incarnations of the Ishmaelites, it's just really very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that I try to do in my work in general, is try to focus on forgotten stories or marginalized communities or individuals whose stories nevertheless point to really important and central questions. And in this case, I think that the story of the Ishmaels, although in many ways they lived on the margins, in the period itself that they became well known, they moved to the center of American society in certain respects. Certainly, to the center of a number of debates that were going on in American society.
Right.
And in other ways, their story is really emblematic of one aspect of American history in general, I would say.
Well, to establish some context here, first, I think that we have to remind people that in the say late 19th and early 20th century, there was a set of ideas that were very widely and firmly held, and they were held in the popular imagination. They were held by people in government. They were held by people in the academy. The idea was that a wide range of things determined to be social problems, crime, substance abuse, prostitution, but also things like mental illness, developmental disability, and poverty. All of these things, the idea was all of these things were somehow very heavily genetically determined and so could be passed on from generation to generation.
That's right. What you're referring to, which was really an ideology as well as something that drove social policy, became known as eugenics, mm-hmm. and the eugenics movement was founded really originally in England at the latter part of the 19th century by someone named Francis Galton, who was a cousin of none other than Charles Darwin. And Galton coined the term eugenics, which meant well born. To refer to the fact, what he considered to be the fact, that the kind of evolutionary theory that Darwin found in other animals and and other species also operated with human beings, and that in a kind of social Darwinian way, people should be concerned about good people with good genes breeding with other people with good genes, and people with so-called bad genes, or what was known by eugenicists as kakogenic, from a Greek word meaning kakos, meaning bad. So people who had bad genes or inferior genes should be prevented from, as the eugenicists like to say, mating with one another. And so the eugenics movement really has two goals in mind. One is to encourage those with, as they thought, germplasm. That's how they refer to genetic material, with good germplasm to have children, and then to prevent those with bad germplasm from having children. So what happens on the policy level is, well, how do you prevent those with the inferior genetic material from having children? Well, you have to identify them first of all, and then once you identify them, then there are a lot of policies that you can institute, in which in fact were instituted by governments around the world, and in the United States on the national and the local level. So, for example, you have the development of what's known as anti-miscegenation laws, the most notorious one being the one in Virginia in the 1920s, which became known as the one drop rule, which prevented anyone with black ancestry from marrying someone who is legally considered white. And you have anti-immigration laws, again, during the 1920s, which is when the eugenics movement in the United States was able to, was most politically powerful. You have the Immigration Restriction Act in 1924, which radically limits the number of people from Northern and Southern Europe, essentially Eastern European Jews, Sicilians, other Italians, from entering the United States in the large numbers that they had then up to that point. And then you have what are called compulsory sterilization laws that are passed initially in this country in Indiana, and then in many other states. And those are the kind of the three pillars of legislation, where compulsory sterilization, you can, if you're arrested for a particular crime or you're designated as having inferior intelligence, etc., or you're legally defined as insane, you can be sterilized against your will. So the eugenics movement, as I say, it had an ideology, but that ideology was translated through politics and through lobbying and through alliances with particular politicians on the local and national level into laws that in some cases were on the books until the 1970s.
Yeah. And so as part of this, people who were advocating this point of view, social scientists, others, as a way of making their case, it seems that what they did was that they went out looking for quote-unquote bad families to serve as their case studies. So what they could do is they could say, they could have some group of individuals and they could point to them and they could say, see, this is what we're talking about right here. And there are some very famous examples that people will still remember. And it's interesting that in some recent conversations we've had over the last couple of months that it's come up because we've been touching on this. And not very long ago we talked with the author of a book on the case of Buck v. Bell, which was very, very interesting. And so people
was
still—
Was that Paul Lombardo?
Yes, it was Paul Lombardo.
Yeah, he's a very good scholar.
And
yeah.
And people, if people are interested in this, it's on our website so they can listen to that. But it seems that people now still remember some of the more famous bad families, and people still, the Jukes and the Kallikaks, people still, that still has some sort of, that rings some sort of bell with people. And this particular case, the Ishmaels, fit in, it was one of these case studies of bad families, and yet it seems like that this was one of the ones that now people remember the Jukes and the Kallikaks. Nobody remembers the Ishmaels, but that was still part of this whole effort to find examples so that people who made the eugenics argument would have a case to say, you see, here this is exactly what we're talking about.
That's right, and those were known as family studies. And in some cases, it actually did focus on particular families, but in many cases, they were not actually families, but they happened to be people who lived in the same area and may have, in some cases, had relationships to one another. but the goal was to say that because of the inferior genetic material, certain families were doomed to failure. Hmm. And so, therefore, if you identified such families and demonstrated that over multiple generations you had individuals and particular families with lower intelligence, with higher crime rates, prostitution, etc., things like epilepsy, too, were also considered to be part of this complex of characteristics that these families would have. You could show that such families not only existed, but had to be regulated lest their genetic material enter into the broader gene pool and drag that down. And this is something that's really important to emphasize. The eugenicists were concerned about, and they had a hierarchy which was racialized, of where the better genetic material was concentrated and where the worst genetic material was concentrated. And Northern European whites, sometimes referred to as Nordics, had the best genetic material. And then you move down through the European scale to what are called Alpines and then Mediterraneans. And then you moved into other, at least what they considered to be racial groups, Semites and people of African descent, etc. They were concerned about whites and blacks mixing, clearly. I mean, they helped to pass all of the anti-miscegenation laws. And they were also concerned about groups like Jews or Sicilians mixing with Northern Europeans who were living in the United States or people of Northern European descent. But what really concerned them the most, I mean, and they passed legislation, but in general you could tell, especially in that period, let's say, who was a Jewish immigrant from Eastern Europe or who was Sicilian or who was African American. So you could legislate that more easily than this other group that was more dangerous, which was whites, often of the same background as the eugenicists themselves or of the people that they considered to be genetically superior, but who had inferior genetic material. So, for example, people who were of English descent and in some cases lived in America since the colonial period. And what happened, by looking at them, by looking at their names, etc., you can't tell that they have supposedly inferior genetic material. Those are the subjects of the family studies, the Jukes, the Kallikaks, all the people, the Ishmaels, too, that you've mentioned. Mm-hmm. All of them were actually white descent from Northern or Western European ancestry. And the key was, how do we isolate those people? How do we prevent them or their children from marrying into quote unquote good families and dragging that down? And so these family studies identify these families, say where they are, and then propose solutions like segregating them into so-called colonies, or institutionalizing them, sterilization. Those are the results. Now, in terms of the Ishmaels, it's true that there are a number of other groups. The Jukes, that was the first, and that's not a real name. I mean, it was a number of families in New York State that were identified as the Jukes in what's called the first family study. The tribe of Ishmael was the second family study. Then you had a number of other studies, including the Kallikaks, the Pineys, the Winn, etc. The Ishmaels disappeared for about 50 years from the public imagination, and then they were revived in the 1970s because someone named Hugo Prosper Leeming went back and looked at the eugenics articles that were written about the Ishmaels, and he argued that, in fact, the Ishmaels were actually the first African-American Muslim community. That's one of the most interesting, yeah, in many ways, strangest turns in a story that has lots of twists and turns. And so, although in general the Ishmaels were forgotten, actually there is a whole strand of, since he published a piece on them in the 1970s on the Ishmaels, this revisionist history where he tried to reconstruct their, what he considered to be their true history as an African American Islamic community that had been oppressed by the eugenics movement. There are a number of people, authors, people on websites, who have taken up that version of their history. So they haven't been completely forgotten. It's just that they've been remembered as an African-American Muslim community rather than as a community of poor whites from the upland South, from Kentucky, who moved to Indianapolis and who uh, and who formed part of the underclass there at the latter part of the 19th century.
And maybe we should just at this point what we should mention the fact that this really interesting story that Hugo Leeming wrote about the Ishmaels being this long lost group of Black American Muslims, it's not true.
It is not true. No, I mean there were some. There's evidence that some members of the Ishmael family married African Americans, and so in the sense of an extended family, there were probably some people of Native American ancestry, some people of African American ancestry, but the majority of, I mean, the Ishmael family itself most likely came from Wales. The vast majority were white. They were Christian. The tribe of Ishmael, which the people like Oscar McCullough identified, was the Ishmael family along with other families, most of whom were white families from the upland South, that is to say states like Tennessee, Kentucky, North Carolina, who had moved to Indiana after the Civil War, and specifically, or before the Civil War, but they had moved to Indianapolis after the Civil War when there was an economic crisis that affected agricultural communities in the countryside. A lot of people then moved to cities, and Indianapolis has one of the largest, in fact, probably of all the northern cities, it had the largest population of people of southern origin. And so the Ishmaels and these other families that were connected to them by marriage or just by having come from the same background formed the underclass, the economic underclass of the city in the last third of the 19th century, and retained some of the cultural practices and attitudes from the upland South while still living in the city. And it's those cultural attitudes, in some cases some of the economic behaviors that they retained. In other words, they some of them refused to engage in the wage labor economy. They didn't want to work in factories. They preferred to go around and mend things or recycle things. And those became pathologized by a lot of people and seen as marks of inferiority. In fact, I argue that they were marks of cultural difference, but not evidence that they were an African-American Islamic community. That's something that Leeming, for complicated personal as well as other reasons, created. And what's interesting is that his version, if there's any version that's popular now, it's really much more his version than the eugenics version. Mm-hmm. Both of them are not true. Mm-hmm. There's another version that's true that I alluded to in terms of who the Ishmaels actually were.
Yeah. Well, I have a caller here I want to bring into the conversation, and let me, for anybody who might have just tuned, let me introduce again our guest, Nathaniel Deutsch. He's professor of literature and history at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And if you're interested in reading more on this particular story that he is telling here this morning, you can look for his book. The title of his book is Inventing America's Worst Family, and it is published by the University of California Press. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? Are we wrong to presume that the beginnings of eugenics in the United States in the early 20th century was sort of a precursor to the Nazis? I mean, I'm not sure. Did it sort of, you know, become a fixture in the United States as a political, as a social cause? And then maybe the Nazis picked up on it, or they used it, or maybe they had it already. It wasn't a European thing. Because I noticed the Pope has just left Africa, and he was lecturing them on tribalism and how it's sort of is so strong of a force in countries in Africa that it causes all these massacres and stuff. Could you comment on that for me?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's definitely a strong relationship between the eugenics movement in the United States and eugenics movements in other parts of the world. And it was actually a worldwide phenomenon. I mean, you see Soviet eugenics, you see eugenics in England, as I mentioned. You see it in Brazil, you see it in Germany. And the irony, or one of the ironies in all this, is that it was actually American eugenicists who, and one eugenicist in particular, named Harry Laughlin, who helped to influence the certain key developments in the eugenics movement in Nazi Germany. And I'm thinking specifically of sterilization. Harry Laughlin authored a sterilization plan in the United States, and he that plan was then kind of shipped over to Nazi Germany and influenced the sterilization policies that they had there. And he was honored in Nazi Germany for that. And Laughlin played a critical role in the Tribe of Ishmael story. He wrote about the Tribe of Ishmael, and he testified before Congress in the lead-up to the immigration restriction, passage of the Immigration Restriction Act in the 1920s. And he used the Tribe of Ishmael as his chief evidence that the United States should restrict immigration from places like Eastern Europe and Southern Europe, because, as he put it, if the English, if Great Britain could send over people of inferior quality like the Ishmaels, imagine what Poland or Russia or Italy can do. And so if you look in the congressional record, you'll see the Ishmaels entered into the discussion that led up to that immigration policy. And Laughlin was also instrumental in having the Ishmaels included in the eugenics display in the Chicago World's Fair in 1933. They were put on display as essentially America's worst family, and the Roosevelt family was the kind of counterpoint family, because one of the things eugenicists like doing was contrasting the bad families with the good families. And so the Roosevelts represented the best that America could offer, and the Ishmaels were the worst. Now, what ended up happening, another aspect of the relationship between the American eugenics movement and what happened in Germany, is that when the Nazi Germany became more and more notorious and was publicized more in the American press, and then certainly with the emergence of World War II, the eugenics movement became more discredited in the United States, and ultimately it didn't go underground completely, but I will say it lost a lot of its ability to drive public policy, although it continued to be influential even after the war in the United States in different ways, and kind of refashioned itself. Some of its organs, magazines, journals, societies, changed their names to be a little more palatable and to distance themselves somewhat from eugenics. The eugenics movement in a different form still retained some influence, and the legislation that they had successfully passed during the 1920s, a lot of those laws, and in other decades, a lot of those laws remained on the books in the post-war period. Mm. So it's not like eugenics just disappeared, even when the movement became largely discredited because of its association with Nazi Germany.
Yeah. One other question. It's interesting because the eugenics movement, I agree, it was a political thing also, but they used this sort of false science to justify it. Now, would you say or agree with the idea that genetic engineering, which of course is the betterment of a fetus or a person, eliminate the disease component in their genes.
Yeah.
Is that sort of around? I've talked to someone else about this before as a medical doctor. Is that sort of another way of going around the idea of let's make great people, perfect people, not perfect, but that's...
Yeah, sure. That's another excellent question. I have a biologist colleague who referred to that as boutique eugenics. That is to say that at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, especially in America in the first few decades of the 20th century, eugenics referred to this ideology which was based on a particular interpretation of evolution, the theory of evolution as it applied to human beings, but also social policy on a state level. It was connected in some circles to the progressive movement. There were a number of progressives who were interested in eugenics, as well as people who were out and out racist. So it really, there was an umbrella of people who became interested in the eugenics movement, people who otherwise might be sort of strange bedfellows, but who for different reasons became supporters of it, or at least supported some aspects. What you have now is different. The state, you don't have the kind of state social policy that the eugenics movement is influenced. Nor do you have a eugenics movement per se. What instead you have are interventions or the possibility of interventions by individuals. So it's a kind of individuated or individualized eugenics, if you want to use that phrase. So that individual families or parents or prospective parents can try to influence the outcome of their future child by perhaps aborting a fetus or by identifying certain traits that the fetus might have, or and there's a whole variety of ways that people can employ right now. And so it's not the state, it's not state down, rather it's individuals who are making the decision. And yet a lot of the same assumptions may, in fact, be at work. And it's something that, in terms of my own book, at the very end, I talk about this, that it's worthwhile learning about stories like the Ishmaels, because although now it's individuals and people can say, well, oh, this is great, people have the freedom to decide what they want to do, it's perhaps a slippery slope from that to where the state gets involved. And I think most people would not want the state involved in the ways that it was involved at the beginning of the 20th century.
Hmm. Well, again, I want to thank the caller. We're a little bit past our midpoint here. Others are certainly welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Again, our guest is Nathaniel Deutsch. He's a professor of literature and history at University of California, Santa Cruz. The book that we're talking about is Inventing America's Worst Family, Eugenics, Islam, and the Fall and Rise of the Tribe of Ishmael. I'd like to go back just to, and have you talk a little bit about Oscar McCullough. This is the man, the minister in Indianapolis in the late 1870s that I talked about, the man who gets the credit for discovering, we'll put that in quotes, for discovering the Ishmaels. Who was Oscar McCullough?
Oscar McCullough was a Congregationalist minister who traveled around the Upper Midwest and then settled in Indianapolis, and in many ways he was an extremely hardworking person and actually accomplished a lot of good during his short life. He died young. He did not do what he did with the Ishmaels out of malice. And what he did with the Ishmaels is that he identified them as one of these families, as the worst family in Indianapolis, and as a potential public crisis, as a threat to the social fabric of Indianapolis unless something was done to prevent them from kind of destabilizing the society as a whole. He did it because he was concerned about the poor, and the problem was that he accepted a certain division that a lot of people did at that time, and some people still do today, which is, as you mentioned at the outset of this program, which is between the deserving and the undeserving poor. Mm-hmm. And McCullough worked tirelessly, and I mean tirelessly. This guy set up, so if you look at what he accomplished in the relatively few years he was in Indianapolis, to help what he considered to be the deserving poor. He set up job training programs, shelters. He would literally, you know, he would go out, walk around the town, try to, you know, help poor people whom he encountered. He would set up a milk bar as an alternative to a tavern. And I don't know how popular that was, but people could come and drink milk job training, as I mentioned. So for the deserving poor, he was really quite extraordinary individual. The problem was there were some people whom he and others considered to be the undeserving poor. And in Indianapolis, it was the Ishmaels who were at the center of what he saw as a kind of network of undeserving poor families. What did that mean? Well, this was a distinction that went all the way back to at least the Elizabethan period, and you have Elizabethan laws that make that distinction. And then it gets taken over into American society. And the notion is that some people who are poor deserve to get charity. So that's what it means to to be deserving, the deserving poor. And those would be, let's say, women whose husbands die and are left with children to support and cannot support themselves. Therefore, therefore, private individuals or perhaps even the state should intervene and help them. The undeserving poor would be, let's say, a 25-year-old guy who's in good health and who for whatever reason, doesn't have a job to support himself or his family, okay? Women who have children out of wedlock, another category, major category of the undeserving poor. And so those people should be treated differently. And basically McCullough argued that charity just of any sort, whether it's coming from the, at that point they didn't have government, they didn't have welfare on any kind of national scale, but there was something called a township trustee in Indianapolis who would distribute some monies to poor people, but more of it was, you know, the benevolence of individuals or of societies that were set up, private societies that were set up or institutions that were set up by private citizens rather than by the government, that they, those people should not help the undeserving poor. And the undeserving poor, if they were helped, we would just encourage them to not work, for example. Now, the problem in the case, let's say, of the Ishmaels and of Indianapolis in this period is that this was a period of economic crisis. When he discovered the Ishmaels, the city was in the throes of a, and not only the city, the region was in the throes of a, of an economic crisis. And the Ishmaels actually were, in many cases, trying to get work. They didn't necessarily want to do the work in the wage labor economy, but in many cases they were trying to support themselves. And you see there are records from that period, what really should be considered like some of the earliest social work records, because this is when social work is emerging as a profession, where people would, caseworkers, what we would call caseworkers, would visit members of the Ishmael family or other families, or visit or people from the Ishmael family or other families would petition to get aid. And they're not asking for like a regular check or anything like that. They might be asking for a pair of shoes for a kid or some coal because it's cold during the winter. And you'll see that they'll get rejected for being undeserving. You know, so the kids will just have to go without shoes. And that's some. McCullough was someone who had a lot of sympathy for poor people, and really put his money where his mouth was when it came to what he considered to be deserving poor. At the same time, he was one of the most important and earliest figures in suggesting that the undeserving poor might have a hereditary component to why they were behaving in the ways that they did. And that's one of the things that he adds to the whole debate or, you know, history of deserving and undeserving poor, is that he's one of the first to move it. Although he kind of balanced, or he accepted that there was some environmental input into this, he also suggested in the brief piece he published on the Tribe of Ishmael, which was the first piece published on them, he suggested that there might be a hereditary component. And so that starts them on the path. Eugenics didn't exist yet as a movement in the United States. It's what would be known as sort of early hereditarian theory at that point. But the Ishmaels become one of these first, one of the first groups, and in terms of the connection to the undeserving poor, one of the first cases where someone starts to suggest that, oh, you know why these people have ended up like they do? It's not just because they had bad breaks or the environment, they were in a tough environment. There may also be some kind of hereditarian or to use more contemporary language, genetic reason for that. And that's in a really important turning point. In a few decades, that is going to become the kernel. And McCullough's work, he's going to be seen as one of the ancestors and the inspirations for the American eugenics movement.
Yeah. Other people take that and they pick it up and they carry it on. And,
exactly.
And people like Arthur Estabrook and Harry Laughlin.
And people who are much, much less sympathetic figures, much less concerned about going out and helping helping the poor or helping people who are down on their luck. I mean, McCullough actually did a tremendous amount in that regard. People like Charles Davenport, Harry Laughlin, Arthur Estabrook, they belong to a different category than he does. They were scientists, and that's actually an important thing to point out. It wasn't that, I mean, these were people who were trained at in many cases, major research universities, places like University of Chicago or Harvard. I mean, these are they were. This was not in the margins. These were, I mean, we can retrospectively look back and say this was pseudoscience. In its day, it had all the, you know, it had journals, the people who, it had research institutes, experimental stations, as they called them. They would go out and do field work. And the people who were involved in it were not only trained in America's best institutions, the president, one of the presidents of Stanford, David Starr Jordan, was a eugenicist, for example. But they were also funded by people like Andrew Carnegie, by the Carnegie Foundation, Harriman, some of the major families and philanthropic institutions in the United States helped to support eugenics financially, and without that financial support, it would have been impossible for them to achieve the policies that they did. So, and there was very little attempt to there's very little attempt to try to understand the complex reasons for how people might end up in the situations that they did. Reasons that had, in my mind, were really environmental. The eugenicists wanted to reduce it to genes.
Yeah. I want to make sure that we talk some more about Hugo Leeming, because here we have talked about Oscar McCullough, talked about the how it is he came across these people and wrote about them, and then how this story was taken up, and about the fact that, say, at one time in America, maybe particularly in the 20s, people had heard of the Ishmaels and that they were the case, one of the case studies for bad families and
yeah.
This idea. So then we jump up into the 1970s, and at this point, people basically have forgotten the Ishmaels. That story is gone. But now we see this interesting reincarnation, reimagining, rediscovery of the Ishmaels by this man, Hugo Leeming, who tells this completely different story about them.
Right.
Where did he get this idea?
I mean, their story would be interesting enough if it just remained in the arena of what we've been talking about, eugenics and the undeserving poor. But what ended up happening, and actually it was through Leeming's account that I first encountered the tribe of Ishmael.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know about the eugenic stuff except through Leeming's account. My brother actually handed me a chapter that Leeming wrote and that was published in the book in the 1970s, and about the tribe of Ishmael. I read it and I was like, wow, this is really fascinating. This is the first African-American Islamic community, and look, their history has been completely erased, and this guy has recovered it. And Leeming claimed that the Ishmaels were among the founders of the Moorish Science Temple, which is widely considered to be, the first African-American Islamic community, and as well as the Nation of Islam, both of which gained prominence in the Upper Midwest around where the tribe of Ishmael was, and so I found it was absolutely extraordinary. And I pretty much took it at face value when I read it. But then I decided, as I got more interested, I decided I was going to do a little research and went on the web and found out that descendants of the Ishmaels had a genealogical website.
Mm-hmm.
And it became clear from reading the postings on this website that they were not members of a African American Islamic community, and that it's very unlikely that their ancestors were. And so then I started to contact members of the family, and the story unfolded from there. I spent a number of years researching it, and also researching Hugo Leeming, who was himself born into a white Christian family, and in later in his life reconstructed his own identity, or you might say reimagined his own identity, depending on your perspective, as someone who was of what he called tri-racial heritage, Native American, African American, white American, and he actually joined the Moorish Science Temple, as an African American man.
Hmm.
So, in other words, there's a parallel between his transformation of the Ishmaels from white Christians into African American Muslims, and his own self transformation. Now, he would say that he was recovering the identity of the Ishmaels and recovering his own true identity. You see, So some of it is just one's perspective on this. Now, I went and reconstructed as best I could the Ishmaels' history in the United States, the history of the family, and trying to get back to, I went to Wales, to St. Ishmael's, there's a town called St. Ishmael's there, and to see whether I could recover any connection to where they came from in Europe, and looked at colonial records and military records and census records, etc., to try to tell another version of their story, one that was documented in those kinds of things. I should say one other thing, which is that Leeming claimed that the founder of the Ishmael family, someone named Benjamin Ishmael, who lived during the colonial period and during the early United States period of the United States after the Revolutionary War, he actually fought in the Revolutionary War. It's something I talk about in my book. He claimed that Ben Ishmael was really a kind of transformation of Ibn Ishmael, and that he was an African. Either from Africa himself or descendant of African Muslims, and that he was the sort of linchpin in the establishment of the tribe of Ishmael as an African American Islamic community. In fact, he was not what Leeming claimed he was, but there were other African Muslims who were brought to this country as slaves, and scholars differ, but some percentage, a significant percentage, of the slaves who were brought to America were Muslim. And so one of the things I talk about in my book is that although Leeming was wrong about the Ishmaels, what he illuminates is something that actually was true, which is to say that there could have been someone named Ben Ishmael. In fact, there are other African Muslims living in America in the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century, who have names remarkably similar to Ben Ishmael. So in a way, he kind of inadvertently reveals an important aspect of American history, namely that, and something that people don't give a lot of thought to typically, although there have been a number of good works written about it, there have been Muslims, African Muslims here, or Muslims of African descent, for centuries. And there's a whole other story about, well, what happens to those Muslim slaves, you know, over time? And so that was one of the things that interested me about the tribe of Ishmael story and Leeming's version of it, is that although what he was arguing wasn't true, it pointed to a truth that was also, as you put it, sort of a forgotten, something forgotten about American history, although, as I say, there have been a number of works written about it.
We have just about 5 minutes left. I have a caller here I want to try to get in and talk with him, so let's do that. Champagne is the caller in line number one. Hello.
Hello. I have one question, and I'll save it till last, but I did want to mention that I think we're in a sort of a gray area when we're talking about the history of science or the history of philosophy or just about anything. We're in danger of projecting today's standards onto the people that we're, you know, observing in the past. And I do think that, you know, as far as Darwin is concerned, he was more or less accountable for his work, and he was accountable to the Royal Academy of Science in in Britain. And so, I mean, he would have been, I think, trying to be as objective as possible in the terms of his day. And I would mention also that he didn't really invent social Darwinism. It was Herbert Spencer, and I've yet to read any of Spencer's books, but I'd like to sometime because just from the titles, I think that he apparently had a very rational approach to social science. He was not a person who believed in a kill or be killed, survival of the fittest world.
Yeah, if you have a question, we kind of need to get to it because we're really short on time.
Yeah, well.
Well, I would say to that, this is not, I don't mean this as an indictment of Darwin or of the theory of evolution. This is a question of when you try to apply evolution to social policy. That's what the eugenics movement tried to do. Now, you could legitimately accuse them of bad science well.
Yes, but it's unethical unethical science. But I don't think it's fair to compare unethical science to the outrage of the Nazi Holocaust, because the Nazis were fanatical criminals and they had taken control of an entire nation.
Well, what happens, I think, in both cases is you see science being employed, for nefarious political activities and
well, yes,
policies.
But you also have to bring scientists into the discussion, which is my question. Mm-hmm. Have you, in the course of doing your research, have you discussed any of these matters with scientific ethics and genetics?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I mean, I've had a number of conversations with geneticists and other biologists about this and about the relationship of contemporary genetics and biology to eugenics and what role what the relationship is of this movement to their own fields. Absolutely. I think that's very important.
We're here at the point we have maybe about a minute or so left. There's just one last little detail that I think is really interesting that I want you to talk about for a minute or so, and that is the fact that in the course of doing the research in the book and doing research on the Ishmael family, you had contact with some contemporary Ishmael family members. And the thing that's interesting is that the story of the Ishmaels that we've been telling, they'd never heard this story.
Yeah, I mean, the ones that I contacted, that's what they said, and in large part because, you know, these are people who are successful people, you know, and the eugenicists turned out to be wrong. I mean, at one point in the 1920s, they were suggesting that the so-called tribe of Ishmael posed a threat to the fabric of the entire United States. And if they were allowed to continue to "quote unquote" breed, they could drag down the United States. And in fact, what we find is that the eugenics movement is long gone, but the Ishmael family is still around. And as I said, they have the genealogical website, they have family reunions, and in large part, I think they didn't know because the predictions of the eugenics movement didn't come to pass.
Mm-hmm. Well, apparently, not only did they not know that, they also didn't know that they were a long lost bunch of African American Muslims. They didn't know that either.
No, they didn't. And that was, I mean, one of the interesting things for me in my research was communicating those theories to them and talking to them about that and hearing their reaction. And it sort of ranged from just shock. You know, some people thought it was funny. Some people were very interested.
Well, just now, what sort of takeaway idea would you like to leave with folks here in the last about 30 seconds to a minute?
Yeah. Well, we are living in a time right now where poverty is on the increase, and where the question of deserving and undeserving poor, I think, is going to be it's never gone away, but it's going to probably become more and more germane to contemporary discussions of what's going on in America right now. And so I think it's really important to take a look at the ways in which these categories have been seen in the past, and to realize that one person's what might look like someone who's as being undeserving, there are a lot of complicated reasons how someone can end up without a job, and we should look to, in my opinion, try to construct social policies that lift all the boats and not focus on who's deserving and who is undeserving.
All right. We'll have to stop there, but for people who are listening who would like to read more in greater depth on the story, the book to look for is Inventing America's Worst Family, Eugenics, Islam, and the Fall and Rise of the Tribe of Ishmael. It's published by the University of California Press by our guest Nathaniel Deutsch. He's professor of literature and history at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Professor Deutsch, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.